Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. The toll of COVID-19. Deaths in the U.S. exceed 30,000 as millions of Americans file first-time unemployment claims. Then, feeling the pain, hearing from Americans who have lost their jobs after the pandemic erases a decade of employment gains. Plus, empty skies. With passenger demand in freefall, how will air travel survive the coronavirus?
The airline industry, not just in the US, but worldwide, is in a complete crisis. Markets have evaporated. Airlines need cash at the moment just to survive.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. At the White House tonight, President Trump is putting out guidelines for starting to end the shutdowns imposed as a result of the pandemic. Across the nation, officials have put out new numbers on COVID-19's toll in lives and livelihoods. Nearly 32,000 dead and millions more thrown out of work. Amna Nawaz begins our coverage.
As the COVID-19 pandemic ravages the economy, another 5.2 million Americans filed for unemployment last week. That new jobless claims total of 22 million people means that all the gains of the last 10 years were wiped out in just 4 weeks. The economy also lost 70,000 jobs in March, ending a 113-month streak of job growth, a stunning turnaround after hitting 50-year unemployment lows just months ago. The economic freefall is further fueling President Trump and others' efforts to end shelter-in-place rules and reopen parts of the country. On a call with all 50 governors today, sources tell the PBS NewsHour the president laid out a three-phase approach to lifting state restrictions, with guidelines for individuals, employers, and other groups like schools, bars, and hospitals. He told governors they could, quote, call their own shots on when to reopen. Earlier today, Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards underscored the need to reopen state businesses.
We're not going to get back to normal until we have a vaccine and some effective therapeutic treatments, but we're not going to wait till then before we start to reopen the economy.
But New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio warned the president's rush to restart could backfire and cause a boomerang effect.
If he is smart about it and careful about it, we can actually get to a restart of the economy we can sustain. If he jumps too soon, it'll be horrible. It'll set us back further.
And seven governors in the Midwest announced today they'll work in coordination to reopen their economies, following similar agreements earlier this week by governors in the Northeast and governors on the West Coast. The immediate effects of the economic downturn are already being felt. Food pantry providers say demand is skyrocketing, but donations have declined. In Dallas, Texas today, cars snaked along the highway, waiting for National Guard troops to distribute boxes of food. And millions of Americans anticipating their $1,200 stimulus checks will have to wait longer, as technical glitches keep those who file taxes with services like TurboTax or H&R Block from receiving those funds. As they navigate the economic burdens, Americans also face grim new developments in the public health crisis. Sioux Falls, South Dakota is now a new national hotspot after more than 640 cases were traced back to a Smithfield pork plant since shuttered. In a small New Jersey town, the virus continues to devastate nursing home populations. According to the New York Times, police there discovered 17 bodies inside one facility where 68 people recently died. 26 had tested positive for COVID-19. Countries around the world are also still grappling with containing the virus and mitigating the financial fallout. In northeastern France, an optical business owner says he's looking at months of lost business and doesn't know how he can safely reopen his shop.
I don't see how we can fit glasses on people wearing masks. Masks that we don't yet have at the moment in any case. I don't see how I can ask my employees to work without masks.
Authorities in Greece have tightened restrictions ahead of Sunday's Orthodox Easter. Police are now stopping and questioning drivers. Anyone traveling for the holiday faces a fine of €300 or $326. a similar lockdown in Japan, with more than 9,000 COVID-19 cases and nearly 200 deaths, and where Prime Minister Shinzo Abe today declared a nationwide emergency to discourage travel during an upcoming holiday.
We ask local governments to urge residents not to take non-essential, non-urgent trips back to their hometowns or any trips that involve travel between areas and prefectures to avoid the spread during the Golden Week.
The latest celebration on hold as the world struggles to stop the virus spread. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Amna Nawaz.
We had planned to bring you an interview tonight with Vice President Mike Pence. His office had to reschedule, and we hope to have that conversation tomorrow. Now, this country is experiencing a sudden spike of job loss not seen since the Great Depression of almost a century ago. 22 million jobs lost in about a month, with many more cuts to come, and a sense that these numbers don't fully capture what's really happening. We're going to focus on this extensively from a number of angles. Let's start by hearing from some who've lost their jobs or have had to shut down most of their business and are struggling.
I'm Kamisa Carter. I live in Jacksonville, Florida, and before the COVID-19 pandemic, I was a substitute teacher.
My name is Josiah Welch. I live in Longview, Washington.
My name is Jennifer. I am here in Las Vegas, Nevada.
My name is Austin McMullen. I'm 31 years old, living up here in Raleigh, North Carolina.
I am Sunyata Amen of Calabash Tea and Tonic in Washington, D.C.
I'm Alana Calhoun. I was previously working for an interpreting agency.
I bought some food for myself and for my family so they can have some food to survive. And right now, it's just I just don't have nothing in my bank account. I just, not even savings. It's just been really tough.
Between both shops, we're used to serving 400 and upwards people a day. And so to go from that to no people a day was tremendously disheartening. You still have rent and you still have lights and you still have bills and you still have staff. It's intense.
I was in sales for a major hotel company and I was living on 100% commission. So that is completely pulled out from under me.
I'm a single parent of two young men. So I just try to hold it together. And I've been talking with a lot of my creditors to make arrangements and to get extensions on a lot of things.
I've always been like the breadwinner, you know, like I've been the one to support my family, and just it's really hard right now, like to think about everything.
I ended up getting immediately furloughed the day after I had moved everything in and returned my U-Haul. So I didn't actually technically get to work even one day. It was just a devastating knock to the stomach that it was almost hard to like overcome. And like I went to not a dark space, but like a self-reflecting, like, what in the hell am I going to do for about a couple of days after that phone call?
I hang my hat, you know, take a lot of pride in being an employer and have so for years, and being able to offer health insurance and things like that through our business. It's heart-wrenching to have to say to half your staff, look, you guys have to stay home.
Approaching your parents basically with your tail tucked between your legs as an adult saying, so is there any way that you could help me through this, is not an easy thing to do. If it weren't for my parents assisting me, I wouldn't know that I'll be able to have all the ducks in place to make sure I don't lose my home before this is over.
Right now, I'm fortunate in the fact that we are not in extreme dire straits right now. I fear that I'm not going to be able to pay our bills, that eventually we're going to become homeless, and that scares me.
You expect that every 2 weeks or every week you get a check coming in so you can stay afloat. But with all this and people not having jobs, it's like that little anchor is gone. And it's just terrible.
And we so appreciate each one of you telling your story. The primary engine of the U.S. economy is small businesses, and they are some of the hardest hit. On top of that, a new blow hit today. The massive $349 billion relief program aimed at helping them is now out of money. Our Lisa Desjardins joins me to tell us what's happening in Congress to try to get help to small businesses and to their employees. So, Lisa, tell us what did happen on all this today, and what exactly does this program mean for small business?
Judy, the fact that this program is now out of money means no more relief will be going out until Congress fixes this problem and adds more funding. What this program is, Judy, is essentially the most wide-sweeping lifeline ever to businesses in America. It is intended to help small businesses stay open, and it would give small businesses an unprecedented amount of relief, 8 weeks of payroll that the U.S. government essentially will pay for entirely, as well as lease and utility costs. So it is something a lot of small businesses say they need. But Judy, because of the demand rising so fast, a tsunami of demand from small businesses, that $349 billion is already gone in just 2 weeks. In those 14 days, Judy, that amount of relief is more than the Small Business Administration has given out in 14 years. So it's rather remarkable what they've done, but it just shows how immense the need is.
So, Lisa, how is it that this one program, and whether it's continued or not, is going to matter so much?
Right, and I should say there is a second program also for small businesses that has similarly reached its maximum funding, but this one is more funding for businesses. Judy, talking about how important small businesses are, the reason for this program, look at this. Small businesses make up 48% of the workforce in the United States. The number of those businesses, we're talking about 30 million small businesses. Most of them would be eligible for this money. But Judy, because of the money running out, just 1.6 million of those businesses were able to get this money approved. And Judy, tonight, many businesses don't know if they got that money or if not. For example, the tea shop owner in that lovely story that we just said, showing about people's needs, she has applied. She's not sure if she's getting the money yet or not.
And Lisa, you've been reporting on the negotiations about all this underway between members of leaders in the Congress, the Trump administration. At one point, you said it looked promising. What's happened?
Well, the promise is that it seems Republicans may be open to some ideas from Democrats, but let me back up and explain what's happening. Democrats are the ones who are essentially refusing to add more funding just on its own. So let's look at where two sides are. First of all, the Republicans here right now, they have proposed for over a week adding $250 million to this program. Just that, nothing else. Democrats, however, say that they need some of that money to specifically go to some areas that are underserved, that they don't think that money is reaching right now. They also want more money right now for states and for hospitals. They say those are urgent needs as well and need to be passed immediately. So, Judy, it's a strange situation where nearly everyone agrees all of these areas need money, but they disagree over timing. And, Judy, the pressure will be on Democrats over the weekend to see kind of if there's a political fallout from them blocking more money for this program. It will likely be days, at least until next week, before Congress can pass any fixes for this.
And just quickly, Lisa, what's the difference then in who would get money, what the Republicans want versus what the Democrats want?
Well, in general, everyone, the same group of people would get money. It's sort of a matter of timing. Democrats' plan would probably help more community banks, places that don't see these loans often, not as big of a bank. But I want to also mention an important group, the self-employed. That is the bulk of small businesses, individuals like plumbers, accountants, farmers. They all can apply for this money. However, they were not allowed to apply for it until a week after everyone else. That's because their guidelines for them are more complicated. Judy, they're at the back of the line, and they are the most likely to have been frozen out of this program right now.
And finally, quickly, Lisa, where does it stand?
Right. So there are negotiations continuing. Talks go on. We've heard from all offices tonight. But as I say, Judy, even if they reach a deal over this weekend, because of the way Congress is meeting right now, which is barely meeting, I don't think any deal could actually become law until late next week. But talks continue.
Lisa Desjardins, thank you very much for staying on top of this for us. Even as the president and the Congress negotiate over further relief and aid, the job losses are staggering. So far, they are roughly equivalent to the number of jobs created since the last painful recession. Elyse Gould is a senior economist with the Economic Policy Institute. It's a nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. Elise Gould, thank you very much for joining us. As we've said, these numbers are almost impossible to comprehend. 20-some-odd million Americans out of work. I mean, how do you put this in some context? How do you explain it? What's going on?
It's a great question. They're devastating numbers, just like those stories were devastating that you aired. All those people in so much pain. There are millions of them. As you said, there's more than 20 million. Think about the economy. There's about 150 million people working in the economy. That represents 1 in 8, more than 1 in 8. If you look around you, more than 1 in 8 workers have now filed for unemployment insurance. Those are devastating losses.
And you described to us how this is happening in waves, how there was a first wave of people, but now we are seeing this cascade into virtually all sectors of the economy.
That's right. At first, we saw it mostly in leisure and hospitality when we saw the tourist industry begin to shut down. Now you're seeing it in restaurants and you're seeing it in retail. It's really cascading.
And you've also talked to us about how it's not just people worrying about their economic security, it's health security on the line as well.
Right. When you think about what's been happening in this pandemic, there are two chains of ways this is affecting people. One is they're the frontline workers, right? Those essential workers, whether they be healthcare workers or grocery store workers or workers in transportation, all those essential workers every day are putting their own health on the line, the health of themselves, of their family members. They may live with people who are at risk, in particular risk of their health. And so we have to think about those workers. And then we think about the other group of workers, those people that are facing devastating economic insecurity. So those people who have lost their job, who have been furloughed, who have had their hours cut, who have no hope of getting employment anytime soon.
Elise Gould, you also told us that there's maybe an undercount involved, that we're not seeing the true numbers, even when we look at these devastating numbers that are coming out.
That's true. So some of what was passed in the last legislation, the CARES Act, allowed additional people to be able to file for unemployment insurance. That's just coming up online now. So those self-employed workers, those gig workers who can now apply, workers who had to quit their jobs to take care of their kids when their kids' school closed, we're going to now start seeing all of those numbers of people applying for unemployment insurance in the coming weeks.
And finally, Elise Gould, the Economic Policy Institute has taken a deeper look at how women may be more affected by these job losses than men. What did you find?
Well, what we're seeing is that the sectors that are more likely to be affected initially, in particular, in leisure and hospitality, that sector has more women in it. And so we're seeing more women affected initially. We're also seeing among those sectors, women are disproportionately affected. So even more than their shares in that sector would suggest.
And is that something that you expect to continue as these, again, the waves of people who are affected begin to show up and seeking unemployment benefits?
Unfortunately, I do. I think that it's really important for us to track as many demographic characteristics as we can with the data moving forward to see who is really being hurt by this recession.
And just quickly, in terms of benefits, in the past, you know, whether it's women or men, I mean, for many of these people, they've never had to ask for unemployment benefits in their lives.
That's right. We are seeing unprecedented numbers of people filing for unemployment insurance. These are people we know, people in the economy today have lived paycheck to paycheck. They can't go without that paycheck that they need to be able to put a roof over their head, to be able to put food on the table. It is absolutely necessary that that money come through and that money continue till we get on the other side of this pandemic and we can be used as stimulus to make sure the economy gets back on track.
And as we heard so vividly from those Americans whose voices were shared with us just a few minutes ago. Elise Gould, the Economic Policy Institute, thank you.
Thank you.
One of the business sectors hardest hit by this pandemic has been air travel. Passenger volume is down a stunning 96% in the U.S., while airline losses have topped $300 billion worldwide. Our economics correspondent Paul Solman has our story on the consequences. It's part of our regular series, Making Sense.
Clear skies, barren airports, sidelined jets as far as the eye can see.
I think it's going to be probably 2021 before we see a return to normalcy.
Brian Pierce is chief economist of the industry's worldwide trade group.
The airline industry, not just in the US, but worldwide, is in a complete crisis. Markets have evaporated. Airlines need cash at the moment just to survive.
And they'll be getting some. A $50 billion federal bailout, the first $25 billion in grants and loans to pay employees through September 30th. But more than 100,000 people in the industry work for subcontractors, as Herbert Stewart in Philadelphia does.
We had a massive layoff at my company here. They laid off about 600 to 1,000 employees. I will also be, as well, probably laid off. So this is going to hit me dramatically.
I mean, we're the frontline workers, and we were the first ones to go, and I think we'll be the last ones to go back.
Laid off Boston SkyCap Joseph Travers, father of four.
My concern is, once this is all over, there's going to be millions of people out of work. So that means we're all going to be looking for to get back to work. And there's only going to be so many jobs because companies are losing money. They're not going to want to bring us back. And it's scary. It's a scary situation for any family.
Also left out of the federal response to the airline crisis, the grounded public.
It's frustrating to have to be going to your gate and your gate says canceled and next flight is 6 hours away, and then you wait that 6 hours and that one's canceled.
And if you're canceled?
They're really avoiding any commitment to give a refund to anybody.
Sign language interpreter Betty Kolonomos had paid thousands for flights to teach five upcoming seminars. She's refunding her customers, but she can't get her money back, not even from travel insurance.
I feel bad for the people like myself who are not getting paycheck, who need money to live. I mean, if they bail the airlines out, then they definitely should be refunding money to people.
But business is dead, says economist Brian Pierce.
Demands for refunds amount to something like $35 billion in the second quarter. You know, it's the biggest drain on airline liquidity. You know, airlines are going to go out of business.
Generally speaking, are you suggesting that consumers ought to show more forbearance with regard to refunds?
At the moment, the industry is just burning up so much cash, it's not going to be around.
I don't want them to go out of business. I don't want to go out of business either. I mean, I think that's a ridiculous argument because they have not been operating on a just break-even level, let's face it.
They've been running their businesses completely recklessly. And why is it that we're holding the bill here?
The federal airline rescue is fundamentally flawed, says antitrust expert Tim Wu.
They've been running a game where they squeeze people in the tiny seats, do everything they can to extract every last dollar out of everybody to make the most profit they could, and then thrown that all into stock buybacks, and to realize after all those billions being spent, they didn't keep anything for a predictable event like this.
Well, they didn't know there was going to be a pandemic.
Actually, they warned about it, and they're stuck in some of their documents warned about the possibility of a pandemic ruining their business.
But how could they have prepared for a near standstill, asks airline blogger Brett Snyder.
These were relatively healthy companies that could withstand significant downturns, just not a complete destruction of all demand. I think that's hard to say that a company should hold on to multi-billions and billions of dollars of cash just in case this type of thing were to happen.
Meanwhile, pilots, helming the few flights still operating, have their own beef with the federal government.
We have over 200 reports of test positives. We have three deaths.
And four flight attendants have died. 250 have tested positive. Ex-Marine Joe DePete, a pilot for 33 years, now head of the Airline Pilots Association, asked for mandatory regulations from the Federal Aviation Administration last month.
Cleaning and disinfecting of our airplanes, right, to make these ready for flight. The second was the notification to other crew members who may have been exposed to someone who tested positive. The other was to use cleaning solutions and products that were recommended by the CDC to be effective.
DePete says he got no immediate response at a time when, for his pilots, every day counts.
To expose them to additional risks, unnecessary risks, preventable risks, to me is unconscionable.
The FAA gave us this statement in response. The FAA is taking seriously reports of airline failures to follow this crucial health guidance. Any allegation to the contrary is inflammatory and inaccurate. Turbulent times, thousands of flights canceled daily, future bookings down almost 100%. Friendlier skies, perhaps a long way off. For the PBS NewsHour, Paul Saltman.
In the day's other news, Wall Street managed small gains despite the latest job losses. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 33 points to close at 23,537. The NASDAQ rose 139 points, and the S&P 500 added 16. In South Korea, the ruling party has won big in parliamentary elections held Wednesday. Voters had to wear masks and plastic gloves and get their temperatures checked, but turnout was the highest in nearly 30 years. The outcome may boost President Moon Jae-in's efforts to improve relations with North Korea. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his rival Benny Gantz are still deadlocked over forming a government. They missed a new deadline today, and the country's president has now given parliament 3 weeks to find someone who can fashion a coalition. Otherwise, Israel faces its fourth election in just over 1 year. A World War II veteran in Britain reached his goal today, and he raised nearly $16 million for healthcare workers who are battling the pandemic. Tom Moore is 99 years old. He pledged to walk 100 laps in his garden, and online donations went viral. Today, moving with a walker, Moore finished his feat as a military honor guard saluted. He said he was overwhelmed by the response. Inches to
go. It's unbelievable that people would be so kind to give that source of money to the National Health Service, and maybe I was responsible for starting it, but not deliberately.
Mr. Moore turns 100 years old on April 30th. What a great example he sets. And the actor Brian Dennehy has died. His representative says he passed away overnight in New Haven, Connecticut, of natural causes. Dennehy's many film roles included the sheriff in First Blood, who battles Sylvester Stallone as Rambo. On stage, he won two Tony Awards, including one as Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman in 1998. Brian Dennehy was 81 years old. Still to come on the NewsHour, the origins of the virus, the competing theories of how COVID-19 began. On the front lines at an embattled veterans hospital in New York. The delicate and necessary work of decontaminating life-saving masks, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
From the moment COVID-19 began to spread, there were questions about its origin. This week, there have been reports U.S. diplomats are concerned about a lab in Wuhan, China, the city where the outbreak began. Nick Schifrin examines what the U.S. knows and doesn't know about how coronavirus originally spread.
Today in Wuhan, the markets sell live animals. The shopkeepers insist their product is clean and had nothing to do with the COVID-19 outbreak. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo seemed to agree with the shopkeepers and raised on Fox News last night another source.
We know that this virus originated in Wuhan, China. We know that there is the Wuhan Institute of Virology just a handful of miles away from where the wet market was. There's still lots to learn.
The Wuhan Institute of Virology's website includes these photos showing off its technology. U.S. officials tell PBS NewsHour they've long been concerned about lab security, and they consider the possibility that COVID-19 was accidentally released by a lab employee who was working with animals that carry coronaviruses.
More and more we're hearing the story. We are doing a very thorough examination of this horrible situation.
But the intelligence community has not concluded for sure that's what happened. U.S. officials tell PBS NewsHour it's still possible the market was the source.
The results are inconclusive, if you will.
We've had a lot of intelligence take a hard look at that. And I would just say at this point, it's inconclusive.
Last month, China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs blamed the U.S. military for spreading the virus. Chinese media have even blamed Italy. Today, spokesman Zhao Lijian said it's too early to know the source, but denied it was the lab.
This is a scientific issue which should be studied by scientists and medical experts. Many well-known medical experts in the world also believe that claims of the so-called laboratory leaks have no scientific basis.
And for more on this, we turn to Dr. Luciana Borio. She served on the National Security Council staff as the Director of Medical and Biodefense Preparedness Policy during the first 2 years of the Trump administration. She's now a vice president at InQtel, a nonprofit that funds technologies the intelligence community is interested. Dr. Borio, thank you very much. Welcome to the NewsHour. Those two scenarios I just laid out, some kind of accidental release from a lab in Wuhan and a possible release in the nearby wet market, are either of those still possible?
That's right, Nick. So the National Biodefense Strategy that was signed by President Trump in 2018 contemplates, you know, three general categories of biological threats: the deliberate threats, an accident from a lab exposure or release, and naturally occurring exposure. We don't believe that the strain has any features that it was a deliberate event at all. Really, so it's a natural strain. Now, the question about whether the original human exposure that led to the pandemic initially occurred in a laboratory setting or a wet market or something like that is going to be very difficult to ascertain. And we don't know.
How would you? Sorry to interrupt you. How would you ascertain that if it is so difficult? What information would you need?
That's right. So it may not be possible just through the scientific means and analysis of the strain. It may need some other type of investigation that is being taken, undertaken by the intelligence community to see what other information may have been available with respect to communications, for example, around that time. But it may be very difficult. And we know that biological threats in general can be very difficult to attribute in a potential source. But, you know, there's, again, either way, what we have to remember today is that we have a pandemic in our hands, and the most important thing to focus on right now is to contain it. There will be a time when we're going to be able to go back and say, you know, what happened? And I have to say that there's more to do globally to minimize human exposure to wildlife in those wet markets, because clearly they pose a threat to our security. And there's also more that we have to do to be able to make sure that experimentations with pathogens of pandemic potential, like coronaviruses, are done in a way that meet very stringent biological safety standards.
So obviously there have been questions by U.S. officials about the safety standards within these labs, as well as concerns that China isn't closing the wet markets. Also among the U.S. concerns is the original virus, the original genome. When it comes to actually finding out what happened, how important is it that China share information that it has from patients, presumably from as early as December?
Yeah, so the more information scientists have, the more they'll be able to understand this virus. You know, there was a lot of work that was done early on when a sequence was posed. They allowed the development of diagnostic tests. Having the virus itself in the right hands and the right labs can also facilitate product development. So it's very critical to share information about something that really impacts the entire world, right? Impacts everybody. And we need to be able to work together to be able to contain it.
And lastly, in the 30 seconds or so we have left, your last point, we have to work together to contain it. I mean, how important is it at the end of the day to actually know the origin of COVID-19?
The most important thing that we have to do is to be able to save lives and restore our economic security and our health security. So that's going to be the most important thing. We can't lose focus of that. We may or may not be able to ascertain the origins. And you know, the important thing is that we contain this.
Dr. Luciana Borio, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
As part of our continuing series with frontline healthcare workers, William Brangham spoke today with Maria Lobaferro. She's a nurse working at a VA hospital in Brooklyn, New York, that has been converted to care only for coronavirus patients. There's already been more than 30 related deaths there. Lobaferro is a member of National Nurses United. It is the largest union for registered nurses in the country. As you will hear, she says her job often comes with too little protection and support.
So, you know, every day is different. I've worked on a weekend where we were reusing the same gown from nurse to nurse, the same protective gown. So when my shift finished, I had to pass that gown on to the next nurse. And then the next day I came back to work and we had gowns. So it's really been very touch and go. As far as staffing, I think that was one of the major issues that we had in the hospital, especially in the ICU. We just tripled our capacity overnight. So there was definitely weeks, I would say all of last month, where the ICU was really struggling. One nurse with five critical patients on ventilators. And that's a ratio that's really unheard of.
What's the ratio normally?
So the only state that has an actual ratio is California, and they have a 1-to-1. And they have like laws protecting that ratio.
1-to-1, one nurse per...
to one patient.
And you guys are at 5-to-1.
Yes. So pre-COVID, generally, it was like two patients to one nurse. These patients are so much sicker than the average ICU patient. And now a nurse is dealing with five patients. So at times, I mean, most of the time, it was really just unbearable. It was really to the point where a few of us had to actually put our foot down and refuse a sixth patient. So it has been a struggle. As far as PPE, protective covering, and protective gear, it's like lacking on the CDC level. If you do a simple Google image search, Italy PPE, China PPE, and then look up USA PPE, you don't need to be a nurse or a doctor or a medical professional to tell that our country is lacking seriously. I mean, in other countries, if you look at the healthcare infection rate, significantly lower than what the U.S. is at right now. And why is that? Like, other countries are in a full-on astronaut suit where they don't have any part of their skin exposed. But yet, for the U.S., we're just in like a little thin paper gown. And sometimes you're reusing that gown. How many more medical professionals need to get sick or even die for them to realize that? But it's a serious problem.
That's got to be incredibly frustrating, because here you are doing this life-saving work, really, and, mm-hmm. and the country is tasking you with mm-hmm. helping stamp out this pandemic, and yet you obviously feel like we don't have your back in some substantive way.
Yeah, I mean, prior to this, we dealt with patients with infectious diseases all the time, you know, tuberculosis, and, you know, the things that we're doing today, if we did them then, we would be seriously reprimanded. And it's very discouraging, because I'm going into the room, not the head of the CDC. They're at home. And, you know, it's my skin that's exposed, not their skin. So it's been overwhelming, to say the least, I guess.
When you see all of the support, when people are clapping when there's a shift change or people posting signs, what do you make of all of that support?
I'm very conflicted on that topic. So part of me feels, you know, so proud that my city is supportive. So I'm really overwhelmed by the support of the public. On the other hand, I'm just doing my job every day, a job that I've always done. An ICU nurse, you don't go into the field expecting to not see death. It's expected. But I think the amount that I've been seeing lately has been overwhelming, combined with the public, you're a hero, you know, you're a superwoman. It just really sets an unrealistic expectation of how I can perform at work. The other day,
because you're not bulletproof.
Exactly. And I'm not a superhero. And if I was a superhero, I wouldn't have to make decisions every day. Whose bedside do I stand at? Do I stand at the patient who has a heart rate of 20 right now and is probably going to die in the next 10 to 15 minutes? Or do I go to my other patient who's, you know, went to the bathroom on themselves and unfortunately has been in that for 2 hours now because I've just been so busy? So if I was a superhero, I wouldn't have to make these decisions every day. You know, I couldn't feel as further from a superhero as I feel sometimes.
Well, maybe not a superhero, but you feel pretty close to one to me.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Maria Lobafaro, thank you very, very much for your time, and thank you for all the work that you're doing.
Oh, thank you so much, and I hope you stay safe, and you and your family as well.
You too.
Thank you.
Now, a look at what some hospitals hope could be a stopgap solution to the shortage of a critical piece of protection for those heroes on the front lines. They are N95 masks. John Yang has our report.
For healthcare professionals on the front lines of the coronavirus pandemic, masks like this, called an N95, are essential equipment.
The overall situation is terrifying. This is the closest thing I've done to going to war.
Sidney Longwell is an emergency room physician at Tulane Medical Center in New Orleans.
The patients that we are seeing are a threat to us. If you're going to go into somewhere where someone's coughing or you're putting a tube down someone's throat, you need a shield for your eyes, you need goggles, and an N95 as a basic minimum.
The virus has spread rapidly in New Orleans. Like the rest of the country, the city has a shortage of N95 masks. They're designed to block 95% of airborne particles and droplets that can carry the coronavirus. Before, doctors and nurses would use a new disposable mask for each new patient. Now,
we're issued an N95 in the morning, and you do your best to protect it.
When that practice began, Longwell started taking his masks home for a personal recycling program.
That's oldest, and working way around to newest.
He sets them out on a table for at least 7 days, beyond what's believed to be the virus's lifespan.
This is our version of the Super Bowl. Everyone wants to stay in the game. That's why I'm recycling here, so that if the supply chain's cut, I can at least continue to work for a couple of weeks before I would have an issue.
Now, Tulane Medical Center and hospitals on Long Island, Boston, and other cities have developed official recycling programs.
We're in complete crisis mode.
Angie Birnbaum is Tulane's director of biosafety.
As a biosafety professional, I never thought that I'd be in a situation where we're actually questioning how to decontaminate an N95 mask, but this is where we are during this pandemic.
Tulane's program, which is awaiting government approval, uses a technique developed by Battelle Memorial Institute, a scientific research nonprofit. The Battelle system, which was approved recently for emergency use, treats used masks with vaporized hydrogen peroxide, which has been employed for years to sterilize sensitive equipment.
Vaporous hydrogen peroxide is a great decontaminant because it doesn't leave hazardous residues behind. You will basically have a nice sterilized piece of equipment that can be reused by our healthcare providers.
As a test of how effectively the system decontaminates, Tulane researchers add hard-to-kill microorganisms to the masks before the process. If those are eliminated by the vaporized hydrogen peroxide, they reason, so is the coronavirus. Not everyone is convinced. In a statement, the executive director of National Nurses United, the biggest union of registered nurses, said there is no validated scientific evidence that multiple reuse or decontamination of N95 respiratory masks is safe and will protect a healthcare worker. The Food and Drug Administration's letter approving the Battelle system for emergency use said its known and potential benefits outweigh the known and potential risks. And the National Institutes of Health said the results of its study indicate that N95 respirators can be decontaminated and reused in times of shortage for up to 3 times with vaporized hydrogen peroxide. If it is successful, the system would effectively expand the supply of usable masks.
You want to do hopscotch?
Go, go. You got it, man. You got it. Go, go, go.
And it just could keep physicians like Sidney Longwell on the front lines.
when this started, and we were trying to figure out at what point we would tap out and say, if it gets to this point, I don't feel safe coming to work. An adequate respirator is where we all drew the line. I won't feel safe going into a room without an N95.
He says he's more concerned about his family than about himself. His father died of non-COVID-19 causes late last month.
The hardest thing for me about COVID so far has been not being to be around my mom. I'm literally a biological threat to my mom. I haven't been able to go to Baton Rouge to support my mom, and that sucks. Also, like, I've had a few patients die, and that's, like...
Protecting loved ones, protecting patients, protecting themselves. The balancing act facing frontline healthcare workers across the country. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang.
We return now to the new guidance coming today out of the White House as the president and coronavirus task force continue their evening briefing. Our Yamiche Alcindor is here with the latest. She's just come from that briefing. So, Yamiche, tell us what the president and his team are saying about their plan to begin to reopen the country.
Well, the big news today is that the president has now laid out a three-phase plan to try to reopen the American economy. And he's doing that by leaving a lot of the decision making to states and to governors. He said that he had total authority, but he's really saying, I'm allowing the states to make this decision, even though governors insist that it's their authority. These three phases would happen like this. The first phase would be people would still be focused on working from home, minimizing non-essential travel. The second phase would be where things would start to loosen up, where you would have schools and daycares opening back up. You might even also, the administration says, have some churches and bars opening back up, but that would be with largely social distancing still in place. And then the third would be a phase where you would have big arenas, concerts, and things like that taking place, and you would have less social distancing.
And Yamiche, and what is the president saying in terms of whether he expects these orders to be followed by the 50 states?
The president is essentially saying that he's not really ordering the states anymore. On a call with governors, he's saying now that they're the ones calling the shots. Those were his exact words. So what we're seeing here is the president really backing away from the idea that he's going to be forcing governors and states to make decisions. Instead, he's saying, I'm going to allow them to make their own decisions. The other thing I should note is that there's a big idea now within the administration to ramp up testing, because so many people, executives and state officials, still say that testing in this country is not where it needs to be, and that there's still a large number of people who can't get tests for the coronavirus when they need them. And that's going to be, of course, essential to opening up the economy.
We know, Yamiche, the president met with a number of different groups, including governors, including business leaders. He's been talking to them. What else are you able to learn about how the White House is handling and managing this crisis?
Well, what we're learning is that the White House is really managing this by focusing on what the health officials say, with President Trump also thinking about his own political instincts. We've heard arguments from White House officials saying that they think that leaving the economy closed, it would make more people die, either through mental health or through economic hardships, that people would be hurt more by keeping the economy closed. So what we're hearing is that the president is really leaning in on the idea that he's eager to have America open back up, but also said, he stressed today, that this is based on data and science. And we're hearing from some former Republican officials, including one that our producer Meredith Lee talked to, who said that these are reasonable guidelines. So we're hearing that the president is still leaning into his health officials.
All right, Yamiche Alcindor, following it all, what's going on at the White House this evening. Thank you, Yamiche.
Thanks so much.
Tonight, we hear from Kat Zwick, who tested positive for COVID-19 last month. She spent 20 days quarantined in her bedroom in Northern California. And she spoke to our Brief But Spectacular team then about the experience.
So I'm sitting in my car, and I get a call actually from urgent care, and they tell me that I've tested positive for COVID. And I don't know how to properly explain or describe the both the shock and kind of the immediate grief, I think, that I felt. Like, and almost like a, this cannot be. It's been 10 days since I tested positive. I have been in my bedroom now for 14 days. I run a therapy clinic in Santa Cruz and in Oakland. On March 7th, I was in New York City finishing up a conference for the American Group Psychotherapy Association and felt like mildly sick. And then it was on Monday the 9th that I was back home and I was getting hit now with sort of like waves of fatigue. So I contacted my primary care doc and they asked me, have you had any exposure to COVID? I was like, I think there might have been someone at my conference that left early, but it had something to do with COVID, but I don't really know what. And my doctor said, well, you need to go to urgent care and be triaged in your car. You actually can't come in. A guy from the conference emailed the listserv of all the attendees and said he indeed had tested positive for COVID. And I was reading through his schedule and I realized that he and I both attended the dance. I had been on that dance floor, which was pretty small, for at least 3 hours. And so then I was like, oh my gosh, I've been directly exposed. And then three more people emailed and said they also had tested positive that same day, and they also shared their schedules, and I was at two events with all of them. And urgent care said, you need to come on down, and we probably need to get you tested. It was that afternoon on the 17th that I got way sicker. It was just like a severe amount of nausea and dizziness, and I just had to sleep. My fever went up to 101.6, and I was the most physically uncomfortable I have ever been in my life. It was almost unbearable. Like, I could not stand up or I would fall over. I wanted to just like see my husband's face, and I couldn't walk. And so I was like crawling on the floor out of the bedroom just to like see him in the kitchen. That level of severity lasted about 3 days. During the worst of it last week, I felt extremely terrified. There were definitely some moments when I really thought I might not make it. My husband is calling me like a COVID activist because the thing I feel most passionate about is people taking this more seriously and staying in their houses. Right now, any symptom that you have could be COVID. And not to freak out or panic about that, because panic doesn't help your immune system, but to just stay inside. The amount of support that I've received, I mean, just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people. The emotion that comes up is just overwhelming gratitude and recognizing that, this might sound strange coming from a therapist, but recognizing that I matter more to people than maybe I usually think that I do. When you find out that you matter and you didn't necessarily conceive of yourself that way, I think that does alter, you know, how you show up in the world. My name is Kat Zwick, and this is my brief but spectacular take on surviving COVID-19.
Kat, thank you so much for sharing. Kat is no longer in isolation, and while her health has improved, she is still recovering from the virus. Millions of viewers watched her video online, and she has responded to many of your questions on our Facebook page. And you can find all of our brief but spectacular segments at pbs.org/newshour/brief. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.